The Siege of Vienna, 1683. Sobieski and the Austrians. Now, there's always been some problems between Sobieski and the Austrian monarchy because they kind of look down on him because he's kind of an elected kingship. He doesn't have a long genealogical background as the Austrians do. In addition, there were a lot of other little slights that he had received, and his interest had been thwarted, which also alienated him from the throne of Austria and cemented the co-extension which his education, his marriage, and his political interests had maintained with France. To remove these obstacles, it was necessary in the first instance for the hereditary sovereign of the House of Habsburg to concede to the elective King of Poland the title of Majesty. Now, this is an act of derogation which nothing but hard necessity could have wrung from a sovereign so faithful to the traditions of Austrian etiquette as Leopold. It was easier to hold out hopes, which he had never intended to realize, of more substantial advantages of a marriage between Prince James, the heir of Sobieski, and an Austrian archduchess, and of the establishment themselves of their descendants on a hereditary throne. The devices, however, of diplomacy probably have been unavailing to overthrow the influence of France, which was unceasingly exerted against that of Vienna, but for an accident of the time. The intrigues of the French court were defeated by those of a French woman. Sobieski had espoused in 1665, 10 years before his accession to the throne, Maria Casimir de la Grange, daughter of Henri de la Grange, the Marquis d'Arquin. She had earlier acquired an influence over her husband, which she exerted in a manner almost uniformly detrimental to his peace, his interests, and those of his kingdom. On her announcement of an intended journey to France, questions had been raised in this quarter as to that title of Majesty, which had been mentioned as affecting her husband's relations with Austria. These and such as these were the influence which are said at this crucial moment to have caused the scale to descend in favor of Austria, to have outweighed Sobieski's recollection of his education in France, and to save Vienna and rescue Hungary from Muslim rule. Sincere and earnest in the verge of bigotry in his attachment to the Roman form of Christianity, he could not look with indifference on the probable success of Turkish arms in Hungary and in Austria. He had received, however, assurances from Turkey that in the event of his continued neutrality, the Polish frontier should be kept free from invasion. So the Ottomans are telling the Polish that if you don't intervene, we won't invade your country. Of course, you have the mess with the Reformation. Poland is very Catholic, very Orthodox, not a large portion of the population. So they're very in favor of the Pope and the papacy. I mean, if you go to the Vatican, you go to one of the rooms in the Vatican, there's a magnificent portrait painting of the battle before Vienna with Sobieski leading the troops. So in spite of the fact that the French have really been trying to devastate the Austrians and keep the German countries disunited, followed basically a foreign policy that's pro-Ottoman Empire. Sobieski's being brought up and educated in France, having a French woman, is not going to outweigh the papacy part. He just can't take that chance. And for those of you who are unaware of it, Poland is the largest empire at this particular point. Huge expanse under the control of Sobieski. It's not very defensible because it's basically flat with a few rivers, but it has extreme power. This is the time of the maximum power of Poland. The neutrality that he had been following very strictly was bound by the fidelity with that of the Ottoman Foreign Office, and they had observed the engagements and their last pacifications with Poland, a fidelity which all historians agree has usually characterized the proceedings of the Porte, and which stands out in strong and frequent contrast to the practice of the Christian states. Relying on the faith of treaties, Mohammed IV had left the important fortress of Kamieniec on the frontier of Podolia unguarded. And if Sobieski had sought for an excuse to avoid an alliance with Austria, he might have found it in the obligations of the Treaty of Zerano, which had been so faithfully observed by the Turks. Rome, however, was at hand to dispense with these obligations toward the infidel, their words. Advisors, meanwhile, were not wanting to suggest that by continuing a while a spectator of the struggle, which of course might produce exhaustion on either side, and then by striking at the proper time and in the proper quarter, Sobieski might best find occasion to recover from the Turks the coveted fortress of Kamenyak. It was under such circumstances that the good genius of Christendom stepped in the disguise of an intriguing Frenchwoman, influenced for once in a right and sound direction by his wife, and inspired by the memories of the former victories, among others, of the great battle of Chosim, in which he had seen the turbans floating thick in the autumn leaves on the Dniester. He flung his powerful frame into the saddle and his great soul into the cause, and gladly forgot in the congenial occupation of collecting and recruiting his reduced and scattered army the perpetual intrigues of his court and his household. By the treaty now concluded between Austria and Poland, the two sovereigns contracted a mutual obligation to assist each other against the Ottomans, bringing in the field respectively 60,000 and 40,000 men. The Emperor of Austria conceded a questionable claim to the salt mines at Vesliak, and the more important point of a pretension to the eventual succession to the crown of Poland in favor of his son. He was well advised to exact that treaty, and it should be ratified by the solemn sanctions of an oath administered by a cardinal legate. There is no doubt that the sense entertained by Sobieski of the obligation of this oath had a serious influence on his subsequent conduct. The two parties to this oath bound themselves not to resort to the Pope for any dispensation from its observance. How far it was logical and consistent thus to limit the Pope's power and confine its valid operation to just simply dispensation. The Abbe Coyel quotes that this is a secret article, possibly at the moment the parties were ashamed of it, but it is extant in the copy of the treaty printed in Dumont's Corps de l'Universale Diplomatique in 1731. It was agreed that should either sovereign take the field in person, the chief command should be vested in him. Now, this article was doubtless intended to effect the purpose which it accomplished, of turning to practical account the acknowledged military talents of Sobieski and the terror in which his name excited amongst the Turks. No provision is made in the treaty for a contingency of the appearance of both sovereigns in the field. Now, Emperor Leopold of Austria was certainly no soldier. Though he at one time threatened to visit the army, he was judiciously dissuaded by his confessor, and it's not probable that he ever contemplated an appearance on the field of battle. It's interesting that they wanted to make sure that if both leaders were on the battlefield, one of them would have supremacy, and it's obviously Sobieski. It would also point out that Sobieski's army has a very wonderful force, and that is the Winged Hussar Cavalry. Some of the finest cavalry at this time in Europe. And so they have a very storied reputation, and they will add to it at the relief of Vienna. The sources for this, the Siege of Vienna, the Bulwark of Christendom by Schimmel, the Great Sieges by Meligari, Enemy at the Gates by Wheatcroft, Sword and Scimitar by Ibrahim, and the History of the Ottoman Empire by Howard. So I hope you enjoyed that, and as always, don't forget to come by the website, summahistorica.com or historyaccordingtobob.com, and ask a question, leave a comment, check out the merchandise, and if you like what we're doing, please feel free to support us. Thank you very much.